opposite.
All right.
The first sign.
Let's call to order tonight's meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission. Your roll call, please.
McBride.
Here.
Sherwin.
Here.
Smith.
Here.
Steele.
Here.
Merkin.
Here.
Cable.
Here.
Mins, absent.
Are there any changes or additions to tonight's agenda? Hearing none, the agenda will stand approved. Are there any changes or additions to the minutes from our last meeting? This would have been August 1st, 2018. Hearing none, the minutes will stand approved. Doesn't look as though we have anyone who'd like to comment on our open public comment. You sure?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so we move on. Sorry about that. We'll move on to proposed amendments to Chapter 88.04, access requirements. And Amelia has this one.
Yeah, so you've seen this one before. We took some of your comments and made a few adjustments. The first thing I'll point out is 1B on there. It used to state that shared access easements may be used when a lot has frontage along an existing road but does not meet the required separation distance. With the goal of really clarifying these three categories you see in the ordinance, which are standards for driveways off existing county roads, standards for existing lots, parcels, and tracts, and standards for new lots, parcels, and tracts. We just kind of moved that down. I think also, Aaron, you had a question last time about that and how it potentially conflicted with existing lots that have frontage versus existing lots that don't have frontage. We did think about that. We did some drawings and a whiteboard, in fact, in my office with some different scenarios. And I think what we concluded is that, you know, if you do have frontage and you can avoid a snaking easement, you should. And so the difference is with existing lots that don't have frontage, there's really no way to avoid having a snaking easement leading back. But if you do have frontage to a road and you can meet that 50-foot front width requirement, then you should, because it does prevent issues of in the future having lots behind lots or having issues with fire access. The other adjustment that we made, there was just an issue with the language on the limits on how many two-family dwellings or multiple dwellings can take access off of an easement. We really just clarified the language there so that it clearly states no more than two family dwellings or two multiple dwellings can take access off an easement. It says the same thing as it did before, just...
And with single family, mm-hmm. you can still have four single family homes mm-hmm. taking access off of the same access and drive.
Mm-hmm.
For and lots that are buildable.
Right. And then under new lots, parcels, and tracts, the third subsection, we did add an exception that clearly states that residential parcel subdivisions are accepted from the requirement that all new lots have frontage. And that they may take access through an easement, because that's how it's written in the subdivision chapter right now, and we did have that conflict in the ordinance before, but that's how we've been interpreting it. And then we also, under 3B, I think, Marvin, you had some questions about this section before. This is... I think last time the comment was maybe we should have a waiver process. I'm sorry, we actually got the waiver comment was about new lots and limiting new lots to no more than four.
Yeah, I think the point of discussion that we had was let's say you have an easement road that's serving four residences, but there's a fifth lot
mm-hmm.
that exists.
Mm-hmm.
right now they wouldn't be able to build on that lot, even if it's fully encased, because of the more than four. Right?
Unless there's another way to get to it.
Mm-hmm. And so for new lots, we got rid of that and just stuck with what it says now, which is that current limit of four. You know, new lots, if you're doing four new lots, not just one lot where there's already four existing, that would be a minor subdivision, and those are all already required to have frontage. Any more than four would be major subdivision, and then there would be likely private roads involved or public roads. So we didn't add a waiver process. We just kept it as is so that we're not creating new situations with non-conforming uses or having somebody that already owns a lot that
right.
that they could divide with. Yeah. So that's the main change. And then again, I think the biggest thing is the rewording of the 50-foot width requirement for access easements. So that means that from the front lot line, your access easement can only extend back 50 feet before you branch off onto your lot. And again, we listened back to the audio of when this ordinance was originally adopted and found that there were concerns about folks circumventing the ordinance and fire access and circumventing street specification standards by using access easements instead of roads that met standards. So any questions, comments?
And the goal is to bring this back
for action.
To the Planning and Zoning Commission meeting in October.
Mm-hmm.
So for action.
Mm-hmm.
That will take a hearing.
Yes.
Public hearing, yep. And then on to the Board of Supervisors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any questions at all? All right, let's move on then to 6.2. Amendments to Chapter 89 Home Businesses. Jerry.
That's me. Home businesses, we had some discussion at previous meetings with regard to some of the concerns that we're seeing. Right now, home business permit applications are reviewed on an annual basis, and we're seeing a pattern with non-compliance to the number of employees that a home business can have. Currently, whoever resides in the family, at least one of those persons can and should operate the home business. They're permitted to have one person outside of who resides in the dwelling work on the business. We're seeing situations where there's more than one building being used. And if it's a residential district, they're not permitted to have an accessory structure as in the rural districts. And then there's no allowance for outside storage or display, and we're seeing that occur. So based on some discussions that we had last time, we came up with two scenarios to address businesses that would be in compliance for at least a two-year period, because the goal would be to change it from an annual review to at least a two-year review cycle. And again, give businesses that have maybe two different scenarios going on, one being more of a limited growth plan, and that would be a minimum easing of requirements. And after we submitted this to the Planning and Zoning Commission, I had some thoughts about maybe putting in, you know, what is it that we're really after? You know, what is a minimum easing of requirements? Maybe it's a situation where somebody needs two additional people to get to that next stage. Maybe it's someone who wants to have some limited area for outside storage. Maybe it's a pallet or two of whatever it is that they deal with. And maybe they're willing to do some screening or fencing of that area so it might not be seen from an adjacent property or from the right-of-way. Or maybe it's a situation where they want to bring in maybe a small shed that can be, you know, moved around, and then when not used for the home business, used for ultimate or alternative purposes. So that's the first scenario. It's like a minimum easing. It would be a situation where we would require some type of application submittal, written information, a sketch plan to kind of show existing conditions, proposed improvements, and it would be reviewed by the planning and development director, similar to how conditional use permits are reviewed. We've got the full process for conditional uses, which go to staff, then they go to the Planning and Zoning Commission, then ultimately to the Board of Adjustment for Action. Moderate changes to the conditional use permits go to the Planning and Zoning or Board of Adjustment after being reviewed by staff. And then there's insignificant modifications, which there's just a limited impact, limited deviation from what's already been reviewed by Planning and Zoning Commission or the Board of Adjustment. So it would be viewed similar to an insignificant modification. And then the more substantial option would be a significant easing of the requirements, which would involve the conditional use permit process. So it would start with staff. You know, they would submit the conditional use permit. They would have to demonstrate that they're meeting the standards of approval, site plan, sketch requirements, all the written information that's necessary, anything that supplements that submittal. They would come to the Planning and Zoning Commission before going to the Board of Adjustment for Action. But the goal with this would be to require some type of transition plan, transition information, to really address like the time period for this expansion. You know, whether it's a 2 to 3 or maybe longer period to give the home business owner, you know, the ability to kind of see how effective these changes are before transitioning to a commercial, light industrial, or to a heavy industrial district. And then again, these could be situations where, you know, with this initial submittal, this transition that's requested, they could, after that time period that's determined, whether it's 2 or 3 or longer period of time, they could request an extension. And those could come to Planning and Zoning Commission before actually going to the Board of Adjustment. But this is maybe two ways of dealing with the home business permit process. You know, we looked at some of the adjacent counties, and most of them are dealing with it as a permitted use with some limited detailed standards. Some of them dealt with it as an accessory use. You have to have the principal permitted use on the property before you can do the accessory use. And then some of them had the conditional use permit process with the planning administrator or zoning administrator having the ability to provide additional conditions. So I think part of this is trying to figure out, what is the status of a home business permit? Again, these are permitted in agricultural areas. They're permitted in residential areas where there's subdivisions. Right now, it's, you know, we have limited standards, and if the applicants are meeting these standards, chances are your neighbor's probably not going to know that there's a home business being operated there. But we're trying to figure out a way to transition those that want to grow. Some of them don't really want to or need to grow, but some of them, you know, depending on the type of use, have that goal in mind. So this is what we set out. I'd be happy to, you know, entertain a discussion about it. This is broad brushstroke.
How are you going to ensure that all home businesses are treated fairly and equally across? It seems like it's going to be hard to weed through that everyone's going to have a fair shot at this. And some people, I feel like there's a possibility you're opening yourself, the county, up to legal actions where one person was permitted to do their home business, but another person wasn't.
Are you talking about the initial home business permit application or like a request to expand?
Yeah, a request to expand where one home business was granted that request and another wasn't, and it just seems like...
Well, and...
How is that going to be fair across the board? Because different types of home businesses will have different impacts.
Yeah, right now with home business permit applications, they're administratively reviewed. And so it's an administrative action to make that decision as to whether or not you know, based on the information that's submitted as to whether or not they're going to be able to meet the requirements. I think the expansion, especially the substantial portion of this, it's just like a conditional use permit.
Yeah, I like the idea of home business being like an accessory use, as long as, you know, with based on the current, you know, structure where one external person, you know, no, when I'm thinking of residential, right, no accessory structures, no, you know, things like that, and then the different allowances for, you know, agricultural different zones. But I also like, if you're going to do a transition and you're going to allow, like, possibly accessory structures or additional or outside storage or things like that, I generally, the business as is expanding, if it's going to fit within the frame of the transition definition, is not going to have, it's not going to impact anybody probably beyond just immediate neighbors, right? So I do like the idea of it as a conditional use permit so that there is opportunity for public feedback and notification, things like that, right?
Right, we do public notification.
If it is going to be something that's going to be changed, if it's going to change the nature of the impact to the immediate area, then they should be notified and have an opportunity for feedback.
Right.
By you.
So a minor easing is an administrative decision, so it's subject to the same rules regarding appealing the administrative decision.
Right, right.
So somebody could, if they felt like, well, you let that happen over there, but then you denied me, they could appeal to the Board of Adjustment regarding your...
My decision. The other thing, too, I didn't mention is, what was it? If through the review, if it looks like this is going to be much more than an easing of the requirements, that it maybe looks more like a substantial, then the planning and development director would have that discretion of asking for like a CUP transitional submittal. And then I guess that could be challenged possibly by the applicant as well, getting back to your comment.
I think what I like about this is that it allows home businesses to, it more clearly sets the home business model as an incubator for growth and puts the county walking beside the homeowner in that incubation. Mm-hmm. So that you're saying up front, grow with us, come, let's talk about this, instead of just let's wait until you're way out of hand and then let's respond to it.
Mm-hmm. When you say that, I wonder too if, you know, if we hear from the neighbors that things are not just working out, I wonder if there should be some feedback that's given to P&Z or the Board of Adjustment. You know, but if we're going to walk along with them.
But I think that needs to be part of it, right, which is the... Right, because it's a double-edged sword, right? We have two rules, right? We want to encourage and incubate, but at the same time, we have to provide public protection for, you know, other interests. So,
yeah, which is where I have a couple of thoughts. So, one, for the transitional part, it says in cases where home business is it currently in compliance.
That's the goal.
For a new one? Like, I would like to see it. You can never just apply for the transitional. You have to have a history of being in compliance with the home business regulations. And not just currently in compliance, but a history of being in compliance before you're even eligible for it. I don't know how you write that.
What's reasonable? Is that the 2-year period?
Well, I mean, you could have a business that you start with 100 goats, next thing you're at 400 goats, and before you know it, you're doing crazy stuff. And that could happen quickly, right? So I don't know that you want to put a timeline on it. Sorry. I don't know
for that ag exemption.
Right. I don't know that you want to put a time limit on it, but you want to have shown an interest or an ability in compliance, right? If you're going to start a home business, you're going to do whatever application process or whatever, you're going to do that ahead of time. You're not going to wait until your neighbors report that you've got four cars showing up every day and doing, you know what I mean? I'm sure they do, but you don't want to wait until you are out of compliance or had never complied and jump immediately into an exemption.
The way it's written with currently in compliance, the one that we just had, they would quickly bring it into compliance once they got called on it. So, I shouldn't use that direct example. Someone could be constantly pushing the limits, a constant source of problems, and then quickly bring it into compliance so they're eligible to apply for the transitional.
What about the outside storage, though? I think that, I don't know, you'd have to find a location or...
Yeah,
I mean, it might maybe fairly difficult to adjust.
That's part of the issue, though, right? If you're gonna run a business and you're not gonna comply with the zoning requirements where you live, and you're just gonna do it, and then you're gonna say, "I cleaned it up because I put it all in a trailer and parked it at my friend's house," and then as soon as I get this approved, then I'm gonna bring it back, right? I mean, there's lots of ways around that. But I like the idea of, like, if out of compliance, applying a probationary period, right? You've got to have been in compliance for some set period of time in order to be eligible for this, right?
With a site review?
If you were out of compliance. If you started in compliance and... I'm going to do this small home business, and in 90 days, you're already needing to begin this transition. If you were never out of compliance, I don't know. But if you were found out of compliance, I think there should be like a probationary period where you have to be in compliance for some period of time. Because otherwise you just won't do anything until you're caught, and then you just apply for an immediate exemption, and then, you know.
Questions over at this end of the table.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Now, I've got some questions, so I wanted to, I'm sorry for the interruption, but I wanted to put questions in. Is the proposed new amendment, I imagine what we're looking at here is the bolded on the last two pages, correct?
Yes.
Is this the final
language? No, this is broad brushstroke.
This is broad brushstroke. Okay, that's what I was wondering.
Yep.
Because I couldn't understand, or I didn't know, and I thought maybe there's more to, you know, when you have final language, a minimum easing of requirements, would that be on the next to last page? I was wondering if that would be a permanent minimum easing, or would that be a temporary?
Well, the first one is talking about a minimum easing of the requirements, and that's an administrative review. The second one is...
But my question is, would that be permanent, or would that be for a temporary period of time, Jerry?
The one that's minimum easing would be permanent, I think.
That's
what we were thinking.
Okay. And yes, that's what I wasn't quite understanding. Yeah. Wasn't there, and I'm just... So it's different than the temporary transitional basis, which is we're going to let you do it for a little while, but only so you don't have to close your business down, so you can have an orderly business plan to move. Okay.
Yep.
Excuse me. I just wanted to make sure.
That's a good question. I think because of the limited impact, you know, you're talking about maybe adding one employee or just a small area for storage, it won't be noticed.
So my second question refers, I think, back to what Jonathan was starting to talk about. I'm looking at this and kind of going back and forth and trying to think, what would the guidelines or the standards be that the administrator would utilize in determining whether or not to allow either one of these? And to me, that's where you protect your agency in saying it's not just wide open and the administrator gets to do whatever she or he wants to do, but here are the guidelines, or here's the kind of formula we're using here. And reading it now, and I'm trying to go back and saying what on the first page or the second page would still be applying or what wouldn't be applying, and that's where I get a little bit, that's where I hope it gets fleshed out and we understand that. Because would it be, would it somehow waive two conditions of approval, hazardous, obnoxious, or offensive owing to the emission of odors and all of that kind of thing? You might want to say no. However, we're not going to do it if it's going to cause these problems, correct? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm definitely following you.
Good. Okay.
So if they added a criteria that actually said for an administrative or the minor exemption, if it would be evaluated based on traffic impact, visible nuisance, you know, things like that. You could identify the criteria that's
no nuisance generators.
These are the things that we will look at and evaluate to allow a minor. If it's beyond, if it's outside that scope, then it's not a minor.
And there might be some things that just are, no, there's not. We're not going to do it if it's going to do this.
Right.
Absolutely not. That's why I've been looking at this, and the conversation wasn't getting me to where I wanted to go, which was how do those things fit together?
I think that's a good point.
Yep.
Thank you.
And the time frame.
How's it? The issue of permits. The administrator has the ability to apply conditions on the minor easement, correct or not?
It's could be added that. We condition zoning permits, so it's easily something that we do on a daily basis.
I had one other thought, which is on the very last paragraph of the whole memo. Board of Adjustment shall rule on the expiration date of the permit. And that would be for the full transitional one. I think that's good, but I would like to give it an overall cap.
Like so many years?
Like not to exceed. Okay. So that we're not getting to a situation where we're granting
perpetual
this for 15 years until the guy retires. You know, I mean, it should, on your point, Jonathan, we should be seeking consistency here. And if it's truly transitional, it should have a reasonable end.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, it shouldn't just be an expansion of the home business. If it's truly transitional, it's by definition temporary as you go from A to C.
Right. We probably need to use that in the language, that it is a temporary transitional conditional use permit for a home business.
You say it, you don't define temporary, though.
Right.
Right.
By putting in the last paragraph.
Not to exceed... Right. Five or whatever it is, whatever is reasonable.
I would 3 or 5 years I think would be a reasonable transition period, right? If you're running a home business and you're needing to expand, and then you have two options, right? One is you seek this transition, say I will continue doing it from a home as a home business. As it continues to grow, heading toward, you know, an eventual not home business, or you just move it out of the home into a, you know, another location altogether.
I like the structure. I think
we're in the right path.
I think some standards for approval we put administrator.
Okay.
I think are a good point. Too.
Good protection.
Keep you from wielding unchecked power.
not only that, but it gives people a framework when they're looking into it of
what to expect,
what direction they need to go, or how to do it. And you know, 5 years from now, when somebody's looking at this, or 10 years from now, when somebody's looking at it, that they'll know what was intended with that administrative review.
Aaron, I have one more question.
Yeah.
Once this is finalized, let me ask, how many home business permits do we have in the county right now?
60, 70, 70.
So it wouldn't be out of...
ones that we're aware of.
Okay. So of the ones that you are aware of, if it's 60 or 70, it wouldn't be particularly onerous to let them know about the new ordinance.
Oh, we definitely, that's part of something that I'm going to be working on, doing outreach, and this will be a part of it.
They'd be notified. Because I think if people are noticed, maybe sometimes it won't make a difference, but with some people it could. Because if they don't know, I mean, they're not watching, you know, our minutes or supervisor's minutes to see if anything changes that might impact their business. So if the county can be proactive in that,
right.
Send them the information out and say, this may impact you, call us if you have questions, I just think that's good business.
Well, for several of them, they're probably going to be very interested in learning about the changes.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Other comments on this? Do you feel like a direction?
Oh, for sure. Thank you very much.
Okay, let's move on to discussion of Amendments Chapter 85 and 90, Community Ground Handling.
Okay, so we brought this commercial campground text amendment to you in February, and we added the opportunity to develop permanent cabins on a commercial campground property. When we took the amendment to the Board of Supervisors, additional concerns were raised about preventing these permanent cabins from becoming permanent dwellings. Staff was asked then, following the approval of the text amendment, to go back and reconsider the idea of limiting the number of days, consecutive days one would be permitted to rent a commercial cabin, or a number of days per year, just limiting that in a way that prevents it from becoming a permanent dwelling. So with that direction, we went back to the counties that we looked at previously for text amendment language. And looked for more specifically just language limiting duration of stay or number of days per year. What we found was that most ordinances do not limit that. But we did find that Marshall County actually had the exact same ordinance for commercial campgrounds as we did, which makes sense as we're neighbors. The other thing we did was to contact a few private cabin owners that rent out several cabins. So this wouldn't just be someone who rents out their cabin on VRBO or something like that. This is a business that owns several cabins that are close together, and they're rented out. To see if they have any like administrative rules on limit duration of stay, or if the county had any rules on that somehow built into their conditional use permit or whatever. And what we found was that there weren't really any regulations that prevented people from staying for long periods of time. However, what we kind of found was that it was kind of self-policed. The owners of one business owner had indicated that their rates are such that they're expecting high turnover, so they're going to have to clean every 2 days or weekly. So the rates are higher because of that. If someone wanted to stay for a month or 3 months, they'd have a really high price tag, or they'd have to work out some other sort of structure for fees that got rid of the cost of cleaning daily or weekly. So there's that. it just really, from what we found, it just doesn't really happen. Sometimes they'll work with people, business people who stay for, you know, 2 weeks at a time, and then go home and then come back later in the year for two more weeks. So they work with those people, but there wasn't anything that limited duration of stay necessarily. So that's what we found. So we wanted to reach out to you to get some feedback on this, kind of a perspective on, do we need additional limits? Is what we have the 30-day, 30 consecutive day limit, is that sufficient? Is it necessary? And then whatever regulations we've put in place, are they enforceable? And what does that mean for what we put in our ordinance and what we have to do as a from an enforcement perspective? Sure. For like Story County Conservation, for like campsites, they have a 14-day limit at a campsite, so that would allow them to have the site vacated so they can do any maintenance or cleanup of the site. And that was, I think it really has to do with kind of keeping it a temporary use, making sure people aren't staying there for longer than 14 days. But it also has to do with maintenance of the site. So that's where the 30 days came in. We thought with a private business running this, maybe they would want people to have an opportunity to stay longer than 14 days, but 30 days seemed like a good compromise. So we just wanted your feedback on this.
Like Emily said, most of the private companies that are doing this as their business, most of their customers are not staying beyond the 30-day window. They're staying less than that.
Right.
Go ahead, Lynn.
That wouldn't prohibit, however, somebody from putting together a campground that wasn't that pricey.
Right.
And could, in fact, people, in fact, could afford to stay a very long time.
Yeah. That's enforcing that policy through just their business model.
Right. And somebody
and
have a different somebody could have a different business model, and then where is it?
Exactly.
My other question was, am I reading this correctly? From the months from May through September, how long can somebody stay in a cabin?
Well, so it's unlimited. So
you can stay 5 months during the summer.
So,
the 30 days still applies.
The 30 days for cabins only. The 30 days applies to cabins only.
So H is further modified by I.
Yeah, so the H is what we pulled out from kind of just as we were looking at this, we realized we had quite a bit of regulation for commercial campgrounds in the definition. So that's where that language from H came from. Again, previously we didn't have permanent cabins included in the travel trailer park commercial campground definition.
I'd somehow put those things together, because if you read H without I, you get the implication that somebody could be in a cabin for 5 months. And that's not what you're... And maybe I just looked at one part and didn't look at the other one.
Yeah, I can understand that.
But that answers my question, which I'm glad to hear.
Okay.
Why did you choose to put travel trailer parks and commercial campgrounds in the same subsection?
Like in a definition?
Yeah, or on the last page here.
That was, I took, if you look on the front page, I crossed out what that language that was previously in the definition.
Yeah.
So I just moved the language, this exact same language.
Okay.
To the ordinance rather than...
That was existing in the new...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
I almost wonder if you could break them out separately. I don't understand what a travel trailer parks. They seem like two different things to me, but maybe I'm just
RV camper.
An RV, yeah. So
you're gonna limit the staying to the same for both.
Wow.
Okay, so yeah, so for travel trailer parks and commercial campgrounds, that's RVs and tents. They are permitted indefinitely from the months May through September.
Okay.
During the months of October through April, a commercial campground can be open for 30 days on either side, likely.
Total of 30.
So they could open early, maybe they want to open in April, or they want to stay open until November.
If the weather was like nice that year.
Right, or they wanted to hit a hunting season, maybe they did, I don't know, and I don't know about hunting seasons, but maybe a time in January they wanted to open up.
And that was existing language.
Right.
But what we're saying, though, is that if you own a campground, you're only allowed to have guests 6 months of the year. Five months plus another
correct.
30 days on either end.
Correct. Correct.
Okay. Except for the cabins.
Right. Except for cabins,
why,
which
why do we do that?
May be occupied year round, but not for more than 30 consecutive days.
And I'm just curious, why do we say campgrounds can only be open during those times?
Well, it's probably due to the maintenance that might be needed and kind of a regeneration of the site.
That's okay for the public owned, right, where we can say, but why do we govern that for a private enterprise?
So that's the question we're bringing to
you. Right, that's an existing provision.
Okay.
About the limitation, no more than 30 days total for RVs, tents.
I'm okay with the consecutive days, 30 days thing, right? Because you don't want to establish residency, you don't want to have to deal with that. I'm totally down with that. But I see two things, right? One is maybe somebody's, you know, hey, if I'm a professor at the university and I want to go live in a trailer on a lake for, you know, the 3 months that I'm off, why can't I do that?
And under our ordinance, if you wanted to live in an RV on a lake for 3 months during May through September, you could do that.
Okay. I didn't get that from reading.
For a total of 30 days.
Nope.
Oh, are you talking about during the summer?
During the summer. Okay.
Sure. Yeah, I have a question on H. It says travel trailer parks and commercial campgrounds shall be permitted during the months. So does that mean they're not permitted other than May to September? Read that. It says that shall be permitted during the months of May through September.
Correct. And then,
but they're permitted year round. You're not tearing the campground down.
I think you mean allowed to be open.
Occupancy.
Existing language.
But I guess that's
right. Right. Yeah, and that's a good point, though. Shall be permitted, so shall be maybe operated.
And I really question why they can't be open 12 months a year.
Right.
Well, that's a discussion we're.
If you have winter campers or people that are into that sort of thing, then.
So I would suspect that it's to discourage year-round or all-winter residency in a camper at a campground. But it seems like you don't need both 30 days duration limit and completely shut down operation during the winter at the same time.
I would just stick with the 30 consecutive day limit.
Yeah. Well, and can't do that. Just take Twin Anchors, for example. Those are almost permanently there. Now, I don't know if they camp there in the winter, but those units stay there in the winter. So you can't tell these people that they can only stay there 30 days.
Well,
yeah, so that one we did look into, and that was permitted prior to the adoption of this language.
So it might be legal non-conforming?
And I don't have the dates off the top of my head. I apologize.
I see what you're trying to do. You're trying to have some people don't just live in a camper.
Well, but again, this is a private enterprise. This is a private business. And what we're dealing with is we're starting with existing language. And so we're happy to have this discussion.
So I would start, my recommendation would be to eliminate telling the private enterprise that is designated as a campground that they have to close during any periods, right? So I would eliminate the you can be open from this month to this month and, you know, but not during these months. So I would start there.
So are you going to try to limit the 30 days, October through April, that they can stay there?
So what are we trying to avoid?
Well, that's for cabins, right? The 30
living in campers.
I don't see that. Okay. I don't see it that way.
Because
it says during the month of October.
Because we hear what Marvin suggests.
You shall not exceed 30 days.
I think there are some health issues with living in a camper. They're not built to live in 24/7, 365. They start to get mold.
Depends on the camper.
Right.
Depends on the people.
And then
I agree. I'm not trying to say I don't want people to stay in the 4 months here. I'm just trying to clean this up a little. I don't think that.
I agree. H is confusing.
Well, so you've got 30 days. The way this is, you cannot exceed 30 days October through April. Am I reading that right?
Correct. So that is for that is only for RVs and tents.
Okay. I don't want to muddy the waters further, but H seems to deal exclusively with the operation of a commercial trailer park or campground, not having anything to do with the duration of stay.
Correct. Yes.
So what was confusing is in I we're talking about duration of stay.
Right.
And in H we're talking about what months the campground can operate.
Yes. Yep.
And so you've got basically good weather months plus 30 days on either end, or 2 weeks here, 2 weeks there, and outside of that period if you want.
Correct.
So if we're only addressing that, I guess the question is why do we need that? Why do we need that provision until, if you owned a campground, to say you're not allowed to operate it?
I think I agree with you on that, Marvin.
Me too.
I've got an example I can share. It's a Polk County example.
Okay.
And there is a very nice RV park in Polk County, and the business owner primarily catered to the Prairie Meadows staff, racers, people that worked on the track, and it was a seasonal park, and it was a conditional use permit, and after it was established, several years after it was established, we had a request to increase the use during winter months, and with, from a planning perspective, the planning staff with Iowa winters really didn't know what to expect. I think the technology's gotten a lot better with a lot of these units. But I think the request was to add maybe 15 through the winter months. It was so successful that after another 2 years, they requested to like triple the amount. And they have, people that are recreation users, people that are doing construction work, people that work for Prairie Meadows. And it's very successful. And it's probably one of the nicest parks that, that I've seen. So I think part of it was just not knowing what the outcome would be, concerned about health and safety. That example, it had a very happy ending.
Was there any duration of stay?
Yes.
No.
Because at some point you're talking about a mobile home park.
That's my question. What is the difference between a travel trailer park and a mobile home park?
The newer mobile homes meet the HUD requirements, and travel trailers do not. So they're constructed under different standards.
We have an entire CUP, separate CUP standard for
a
zoning district.
Yeah, it'd be a rezoning.
Simply said,
special
if you
standards.
Stay open for 12 months, you're a mobile home park, because that would put them into way too many restrictions. But if they're home, if they're having people live in campers for 12 months, why wouldn't they be under those restrictions? Just throwing it out.
Yeah. So in Story County, then you'd have to have the rezoned mobile home park zoning.
Okay.
Sorry, wrong language. But it's a specialized zoning district just for that.
Okay, but we also, but the planning and development staff also inspects mobile home parks.
Annually, correct.
Annually, to make sure that they meet certain criteria, because we see those inspections. So if we're getting into the point where we have trailer parks, and campers are being occupied year-round, I don't see much difference between that and a mobile home park.
These would be conditional use permits. Do we have detailed standards for the campgrounds? We don't.
Yeah. These are all detailed standards.
I think that's where an occupancy limit becomes important.
I think it's become important.
Because you're the intent of, as we've defined it, or we seem to be trying to define it, a commercial campground implies turnover of users. Mm-hmm.
Along those lines, I think I would add some of the concern from the Board of Supervisors, from the feedback we received, was, okay, if you have a limit of 30 consecutive days for occupancy, does the person that's renting the cabin have to leave for one night? Do they have to leave for 10 nights? Do they have to, can they go 30 days, leave for a night, come back for 30 days, and do that for an entire year? I think that was a little bit of the...
So if using that, then you could do a consecutive and maximum, right? So you could do a 30-day or a 60-day consecutive, not to exceed, I don't know, 180 days in a year. I don't know, some number, right?
Mm-hmm. I think I'm okay with age. If you kind of reword that, because you're saying you're permitting these campgrounds. Mm-hmm. You're only permitting the campground to exist, the way I read it.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's a good point.
And I think having the 30-day limit through October to April is probably...
But again, the 30-day limit is 30 days of extra operation of the campground. It's not 30
That's
days.
That's the occupancy.
I would say occupancy, not
occupancy.
Yeah.
So you want to pull your ring in there during the month from October to April. You can only stay 30 days.
30 total. Currently.
So what if...
That would be, you don't have somebody to...
You could eliminate H because I don't want to dictate the campground's operation, but you could change it and say during the months of September to October, what is it? October to April, only, occupancy not to exceed 30 consecutive days or... Do you know what I mean?
So it's the same occupancy limit as an I for cabins.
And most of these RVs are not meant to be.
What I'd like to see is not tell the campground operator when they can operate, right? Eliminate that altogether. For guests staying there during the summer months, maybe somebody finds some place they like and they're retired and they want to be there for, 3 months or whatever. That's fine. So between May and September, maybe not put a limit on consecutive days,
But then the October to April, say no more than, you know, 30 consecutive days and, you know, 90 total.
I could actually see shorting it.
14. State parks, 14.
Yeah.
Even in the summer, 14 even, days and you're out.
Even if you're just gaming the system and picking up and leaving one night every 14, it's a lot more.
Well, that's why I would say, that's why I would say in the winter, I would do a consecutive and a maximum. And then in the summer, I don't know if you would do a maximum in the summer, would you?
Well, in the summertime, there's a lot of people who winter south, and then I know several people who have been doing anchors who do that, and they come back in the summer to go there in the summer.
Right.
A lot of people that do that to cuttings.
All right.
Ideas on the winter, though? I mean, for the...
For the winter, then say 2 weeks consecutive and 45 total.
I don't care if they only have to leave one night.
Could somebody tell me succinctly what we are trying to avoid and why we're trying to avoid it?
I think we are trying to avoid the use of campers and travel trailers as dwellings when they are not designed for nor their sites designed for multiple dwellings.
Okay. Yeah.
And also document the differentiation between a campground and a mobile home park.
So you really don't want to, you really don't want, okay, RVs could not at all be occupied during the months of October through April.
We're talking about slashing
that. H doesn't talk about how long people can stay there. That talks about the park's operation. Could the people have the park open?
It does, but then it gets through, it gets into the use in the second paragraph. Your second sentence.
Okay, so when I read use in a zoning context, I'm thinking land use. And land use is the operation of a campground. But I see where you're saying you can interpret that as use, meaning by a user.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly how
I'm
I think it's better than not.
Which is where I would slash H.
Just get rid of H.
Get rid of H and apply the limitations in I to cabins and not make it specific to cabins, just...
Right.
RV campgrounds are not set up for winter. No way to keep the water from freezing. There's no way to keep the sewer from freezing. And RVs are not that cold. It's pretty cold.
Yes.
And you're saying people only have some expectations that they shouldn't
have. I agree. But if there's cabins, cabin's going to be different.
Yes.
And I do know crazy people that actually
have cabins. Yes, and that's why we have a 30-day limit on cabin year-round.
So how is tent camping less dangerous than camping in an RV that's poorly installed?
Oh, I'm not going to say it's more or less dangerous, and I'm not going to tell somebody that is properly outfitted for doing an Arctic camping. Which, I mean, I have a good friend who for Christmas got a new sleeping bag, and so the next Christmas Eve, the night of Christmas, he and his son slept in their new sleeping bags outside in the open air.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what they were designed for. So, here in Iowa. So they're crazy, but there are, I know crazy, I'm not going to tell somebody they can't do it.
What I'm hearing from the whole commission is that we're not in total agreement as to whether we should even allow operation of campgrounds through the winter, but that we all agree on some sort of occupancy limit, mm-hmm. that we want to see them turn over and remain campgrounds, not residences. So I think, unless we have any other comments here, I think maybe that's enough for you to hash out, and I don't think you're going to be able to solve our disagreement about that before you bring back something. You know what I mean? You're just going to have to get something to respond to.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
I just want to put in my 2 cents on this. One of my high interests is that I've been close to Davis Lake, and we're going to get a cabin. And in terms of management, if it can be used all year round, and we've got folks that are in there for 30 days, and after that 30 days, there's nobody in there, but the people that are in there for 30 days would stay longer, that's a management thing that I think we're gonna, that somebody's going to have to deal with. Because if it's a year-round thing, we're paying for the utilities and all the stuff, whether there's somebody in there or not. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you so much.
As far as a public campground, and you say we are paying, meaning the taxpayer.
Meaning the county that owns it, which is us, yes.
Right. I think there might be under a different...
That's not, this is
yeah,
not
that wouldn't be what we're talking about tonight.
With this is about private.
You know what? I know what you're talking about.
Okay.
I said what I wanted to say, and so just, you know, I don't like being corrected like you do sometimes. You got that?
Part of that's for me, though, too. I just wanted to make a clarification that,
well, you know,
that the Dakins...
I don't have any regrets for saying that. Because that's something that's really important to me, and I wanted to say that, because that's going to be another part of it. As far as I'm concerned, in many ways, I don't care if somebody needs to live in an RV on your ground, because that's all they can afford, then that's what they ought to be able to do. And I don't know that that's really possible or even a good idea, but that's what I think.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay. Let's move on to proposed amendments to Chapter 90, dog breeding and boarding.
Right. This is before you. When we were working on a previous ordinance amendment, there was a inadvertently we removed from the conditional use permit table, chapter 90, conditional use permits, 90-1, the language that's bolded before you, which states kennels for raising, breeding, boarding of dogs or other small animals, provided all buildings, including exercise runways, be at least, and then it gets into like minimum setback requirements, 50 feet from property lines, and then a distance from a residence or residential districts of 200 feet. So the language that's bolded, that's what was in the table that was inadvertently removed when we were working on an unrelated ordinance. So the goal is to get that restated in the county's code of ordinances. That's the goal. We just went through the codification process, and we had somebody come in who wanted to submit a conditional use permit for a breeding operation, dog breeding operation, and realized that it was missing. So this is all about getting that language restated back into that section. We did spend some time with Sue McCaskey with Animal Control, Story County Animal Control. She supports the language going back in, also referenced the chapter 45, which they just went through an amendment process, and chapter 45.11 covers private kennels. There's a requirement that they get a license through her office, through her department, before they get a license from the state or from the federal agency that they will be dealing with. There's seven standards here that apply in addition to the setback regulations. So they have to get a license. They have to ensure that their facility is meeting air temperature standards, that there's adequate space for maneuvering, that the waste from the animal is dealt with, that the there's no offensive smells, that noises are dealt with, that there's minimum level of care provided. There's also two references to 4512, which deals with animal welfare and care, which in addition to private kennels also addresses livestock animals. and there's a provision in here that talks about the department's animal control ability to, you know, see the inside of these private kennels. So our process involves it's a conditional use permit submittal. Their department would be involved in the review of the applications. So again, you know, we're asking that the same language be restated, and then just know that we have Chapter 4511, which would also apply to private kennels, and they would have to meet, you know, continue to meet those standards as well. Be happy to answer your questions.
Is there any reason to believe that these standards were not functioning well, or they were accidentally left out?
You know, in the 3 years, I don't know that we've had a conditional use permit. The one that we're going to be dealing with is an existing one that was a submittal for an accessory structure. And we always ask applicants what's the use of the building. And when we learned that it was for puppies, that was our clue to ask some more questions. So in the interim, they actually received the permit for the building, and they're using it for hay storage for now, but they intend to use it for their operation, breeding dogs. So as far as I know, there's no issues with the current standards.
Any comments or questions? All right. Very good. We're on to discussion of the
Lisa process. Amelia. Okay. So this is the example that you guys asked for at the last meeting of how Lisa works. So I've made a PowerPoint with an example. Okay. So the Lisa system, this is the definition in our code currently. It's a point system that evaluates a site's suitability for agricultural use in relation to soil productivity and other factors such as locational, economic, and governmental factors. So those are two separate parts of our Lisa system. That is the land evaluation aspect, which rates soil productivity, and then there's a site assessment aspect, so the LE and then the SA, and that rates the locational factors, so not soil productivity, but really, it's location and what amenities and other access the site has. The Lisa evaluation is given a score on a range of 0 to 300 points, and the higher the score, the higher the suitability for agricultural use. So you can see there's a couple different uses for these scores. The first one is in the A1 agricultural district. If you have a score, a LISA total of under 266, or an SA and an SA score of under 172, your minimum lot size is 1 acre instead of 35 acres. In conditional uses, selected uses in the A1 district require scores under 267, and rezonings from A1 to the or A2 district to another district also require scores under 267 to be permitted.
Just the total.
The site assessment. Only the A1 district also looks at the site assessment separately. So these are the factors we'll look at, and we're going to look at these each individually. So part one, which is the land evaluation, that is again just the average site value based on soil productivity. And then part two, the site assessment. These are the locational factors. So you have the percentage of area and agricultural production within 1 mile of the site. You have land and agriculture adjacent to the site. You have adjacent zoning, agricultural support systems and services. So those are farm-to-market roads, access to co-ops, land use compatibility, which looks at our future land use map, designations, distance to urban built-up area, compatibility of site for agricultural use. So that kind of looks at Is the site currently in agricultural use? Does it have certain size or other factors that make it not compatible for future use? Distance to municipal water and sewer and public transit. So the first one, the average site value, is worth 100 points. These next 10 are worth, they're all, you can get a maximum of 10 points for each category here, but they are all weighted. And so some of the factors are multiplied by 3, some by 2, and just some by 1 to add up to a total of 300. Some of these factors do have a higher weight than others. So the percentage of agriculture within 1 mile, for instance, has a total weight factor of 3. So you'd multiply the 10 points that you can get by 3, whereas availability of municipal public transit only has a weight factor of 1. So this is our example. This is a farmstead, and the person wanted to know if they could divide their property further for an additional dwelling. So we did a Lisa score. This is just the quarter from which it was divided, and then you can see there's actually some floodplain, but the rest of the quarter is an agricultural production, and there is an existing house here located on this parcel. So for factor one, average site value, this is again based on soil productivity. So you have two soil types located on this parcel. One is a Nicolet loam and one is a clarion loam. The Nicolet loam is actually given a crop suitability rating, which is a rating we use in Iowa to rate how productive soils may be, of 94, which is pretty high. And then clarion is given a crop suitability rating of 86. And so a weighted average is computed for those. And for this site, it turned out to be a 91. So that's the average site value for our Lisa's first category. We don't actually do the weighting ourselves. We have a GIS layer that's pretty nifty that's taken all the soils types and split them off by parcel and done the weighted average for us, and you just point and click. And it tells you, yeah, by parcel. Yeah. Uh-huh. So that's something that, you know, we can run an update as well. If, like, a parcel's been split, you can reweight it in GIS. So that factor is pretty straightforward. The percentage of area and agriculture within 1 mile of the site, to determine this, we use a function in GIS where we select the parcel we're looking at, and then we can select all the parcels within 1 mile, and then we can sort those by their tax classification, and then we can determine the total acres, and then we can determine the total acres in ag or agricultural dwelling, and then the total acres in commercial or residential to determine that percentage. So for our example parcel, there's a total of 2,935 acres within 1 mile, which is pretty typical. It's around 3,000 usually. For agricultural acres, and again, this is pretty typical, there's 2,821 of those are in classified as agriculture or agricultural dwellings. And so you really only have 113 acres that are non-agricultural within 1 mile. And so then you come over here to the scale once you have your percent. So 96% of the acres within 1 mile are in agriculture. So you can see here on this scale, if it's a 75% to 100%, you assign 10 full points. Yes.
It's not that it's that significant, but did you say ag dwellings are counted as ag?
Yeah, so there's a tax classification called agricultural dwelling. We typically count those. Those are, I think, you know, this one, for instance, has that classification. It's typically a farmstead with, like, a pole barn and grain bins. There's some agricultural accessory buildings on site, or maybe a small pasture area. I think that's generally that tax classification. Land and agriculture adjacent to site is the next category. We just observe the aerial imagery typically in GIS unless there's a real question about what a site's use is, and then we can look at the tax classification. So for instance, sometimes I have trouble looking at pasture ground, and the cows or other animals can sometimes look like little trees.
They look for the little dots.
So we can use...
Is it a shadow?
It's a shadow sometimes, and I think it's a cow. So we can use, we have pictometry imagery too that we can use to see, and Jerry's really good at this, paths in the aerial imagery, the cow paths, or sometimes there's a watering area in the center of the parcel. Sometimes you can see a fence, just different clues, but we use aerial imagery. And this one can take a while to look at, and we do oftentimes have other people look at it as well.
So your first scan on this is aerial photography.
Yeah.
You don't just default to the tax assessment class. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then, depending on the adjacency of a site, it gets a different point weight. So if you have, I think these adjacencies are kind of like in chess. So if you have like a diagonally adjacent parcel that's not an agricultural production, you take away 1 point. If you have an adjacent parcel that's completely adjacent to one side, you take away 2 points. And if you have an adjacent parcel where it's kind of split, so there's multiple littler parcels adjacent to one side, you take away 1 point for each of those. And so that's, again, from 10 points. For our example, all adjacent parcels are clearly in row crop production, and so no points were taken away based on aerial imagery. And this is a site view of that. So you can see it's pretty easy to see here.
In our example, are we talking about this farmstead as an existing parcel?
Mm-hmm.
Or a proposed parcel?
An existing parcel.
An existing parcel. So,
how many acres is
it? Oftentimes somebody might be asking, can I build a site, can I put a house on a minimum lot size of 1 acre,
mm-hmm.
just in the corner of 40 acres with nothing
sure.
else divided on it?
Yeah.
And at that point, in that situation, are you running it on the existing parcel
mm-hmm.
or the proposed parcel?
The whole 40 acres.
So the whole 40 acres. Or in some cases, it could potentially even be, for whatever reason, an 80-acre
sure.
parcel.
Sure, yep. We would... Mm-hmm.
And even though you're talking about the applicant wanting to do a development or build a home in the very far corner of it,
mm-hmm.
we're using the whole 80 acres...
Sure.
...as a starting point.
...run all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We
so
are.
Your site assessment or your soil assessment is going to be even
the
if,
whole.
Even if the lot where you want to build the house is rock,
right?
It would still get potentially a high soil score because it's based on the 80 acres,
mm-hmm.
not on the proposed.
Which would also affect adjacency of other land uses and adjacency of zoning and distance to urban build-up area and all that.
Right. Right. That's kind of similar to this next one, which is adjacent zoning. So we just look at the zoning map for that. And it's the same point system where if you're diagonally adjacent, it's 1 point. If it's a zone that's not agricultural, you're adjacent, and the adjacent parcel takes up the whole side of the subject property you're looking at, you take away 2 points. And then for smaller parcels that don't have their whole sides cover the entire side of the adjacent parcel, so you can kind of see these are some examples. You'd take away 1 point for each. That's zoned residential, commercial, what have you. So this is actually a zoning map as well. Agricultural A1 zoning doesn't have a zoning color on our map. So, and I think, you know, the majority of the county is zoned A1 agricultural. So this is pretty common not to have any points taken away on this one either. The next one is agriculture support systems and services. These are all GIS layers that we look at. So there's four different support systems and services that we look at. The the distance to farm-to-market roads. If there is no farm-to-market road within 2 miles, we discount 3 points. If there is no grain elevator within 6 miles, we discount 2 points. If there's no fertilizer depot within 2 miles, we discount 1 point. And if there's no farm implement sales and service within 12 miles, we discount 1 point. I have not found one that does not meet these. Emily, have you?
There's a small area, and I can't recall which one that's. There's a small area, kind of north central Story County, that doesn't meet one of these, but everything else is met. So.
So typically, you get the full 10 points, and our example did here as well.
Do you have to spend much time updating the layer, that GIS layer, for these things? Like, if an implement dealership changes locations, or are they so overlapping that it doesn't really matter anyway?
They're very much overlapping.
They cover almost the whole county.
Okay.
There's only one that doesn't. So, yeah. I think that's something we would work with Matt on, though.
And will you explain that insight to me, please?
So, your farm elevators aren't going to pick up and move very much, right? So the grain elevator was 6 miles 20 years ago. It's still the same grain elevator within 6 miles now. But an implement dealer could close or relocate. But since the standard we're going by is there one within 12 miles?
Yeah.
That covers. You put the various implement dealers on a map that covers everything.
They have numbers.
I haven't looked at that.
But if I'm a Case IH guy.
Yeah.
No, I'm just so land use compatibility, this question asks, is the site currently in an agricultural use? If yes, so there's two subsets of questions for this one. If yes, is maintaining it in an agricultural use compatible with our C2C future land use plan? If it is compatible, you assign 10 points. If it's not, then you assign 5. And then if it's not an agricultural use, but agricultural use is compatible with the C2C plan, then you get 10 points. And if it's not an agricultural use and the C2C plan designates it as a non-future land use, the non-agricultural future land use, gets 0 points. So we look at our C2C plan, and again, aerial imagery mainly, but we can also look at tax classification. In the example, you know, there's a couple different utility buildings on the site that seem to be used for potentially livestock or other storage related to agriculture. There's grain bins, and they do own adjacent properties that are in agricultural use. So you can kind of...
You're talking about the example.
From the example, you can kind of surmise that, yes, those... The pole barns, the grain bins, are used for agriculture. This site is in agricultural use. So this is a close-up view. You can see those. This is a really large pole barn. There's another one here, here, and some grain bins. And this is the dwelling. And so they do own some surrounding properties as well that are in agricultural use. Distance to built-up urban area. This one is right by McCallsburg, so we just measure a straight line distance as the crow flies. And then there's a scale based on how far away it is. This one is, I forget the exact measure, but I think it's 1.02 or 1.1 miles away from McCallsburg. So that falls in the 1 mile to 1.25 mile distance from a city, which is worth 7 points. So we did that. This does actually lose points on this factor. If you're over 2 miles, though, you get a full 10 points.
And this would be, again, based on the whole parcel?
Whole parcel. Mm-hmm. So we take the closest piece of the whole parcel to the closest piece of the city.
Corporate limit.
Corporate limit.
Yeah.
So when Nevada annexes 2 miles just down Lincoln Highway in a straight line, mm-hmm. all of a sudden,
a lot
every
of
parcel around there is actually pretty close to an urban built-up area.
Yeah.
You're starting to see how things change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Compatibility of site for agricultural use is the next factor. Again, we say the first question is the site in agricultural use? If it is, the next question is it compatible and viable for continued agricultural use based on ownership, size, configuration, topography, and productivity? And there is a separate worksheet I'll show you that we look at to determine these factors. If it's not currently in agricultural use, this is where we are able to add points for natural resources on the property. So if there's floodplain on the property, you can add 1 point if it's not in agricultural use. If it's open space network, as designated as natural resource area on the C2C plan, you can add a point. Again, if it's vegetation or wildlife habitat, you can add a point. Or if 50% or more of the soils have severe limitations for dwellings with basement or septic tank absorption fields, you can add a point for that too. So there's a total of 4 points that can be added if a parcel's not in agricultural use and there are natural resources or other sensitive environmental features on that parcel. Yeah, so typically with the soils with severe limitations for dwellings with basements, those can be soils with slopes that are pretty severe. Also, some of our natural resources areas are based on severe slopes and soils with severe slopes.
Yeah, from our watershed assessment, mm-hmm. it emphasizes the slopes mm-hmm. being critical areas.
Yeah, yeah. So I think the layers that we use, such as the natural resource area, to look at these factors do take into account slope there. So.
I think there's a hidden philosophical determination here, and I don't know, I might agree with it, I may not, but that is that agriculture is always more compatible with all of these characteristics than any kind of development, right? So agriculture is always more compatible with vegetation and wildlife habitat than a farmstead or an acreage, mm-hmm. and always more compatible with floodplain and wetlands, and severe limits, you know, the so-so soils.
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
You see what I'm saying? And 40 years ago, we believed that farming and conservation were linked together so closely. I'm not saying I disagree with that. I'm glad Kathy's not here. She's all over me. But I'm just saying it's a presumption that I'm not sure that maybe deserves some analysis now.
Well, I mean, we're talking about preserving farmland, not preserving natural resources. This is where you're going.
But like Brian talked
Well, about. Only then if we're deciding where a farmstead, where a 1 acre lot should be or not. Is a 1 acre not lot necessarily more detrimental to all these things than continuing to farm it or taking a pasture and ripping up and putting it into row crop production, which can, you know.
I think it gets back to the overall goal of the LISA evaluation system, which is to preserve
agriculture.
Yeah. This is definitely not the system that's looking at preserving.
Do cities look at a LISA score when they decide whether or not they're going to annex land? So annexation trumps LISA.
We have in the C2C plan, we've identified urban growth areas around cities that have indicated growth. But yeah, that's a factor that didn't come up in that mm-hmm. evaluation. But we do
say we're trying to preserve agricultural land.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But I think, you know, the parcels that may be annexed would have really low LISA scores anyway because
LISA scores because they're close to a city, not because they're good or bad
right.
farmland.
Right. And lower Lisa's score, get the city closer to the land.
Right. So again,
which is what the Ames Urban Fringe Plan is doing.
Mm-hmm. So the there's 200 points that you can get for site locational factors. And again, there's only 100 points you can get for the actual productivity. So it's a 300 point total. So it is weighted more towards locational factors.
So whenever a city annexes, they improve the odds of county development just beyond their new city boundary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you take off points for proximity to the boundary, proximity to water, proximity to sewer. If it's Ames, maybe proximity to public transportation. On occasion, we get some that are pretty close to a SIRI route and do get points taken off for that. And then, of course, other residential nearby development and adjacent properties that are zoned differently, maybe because they're in the city. So,
mm-hmm. I'm not casting any judgment here. I just think it's fascinating. I think it's worth asking what are goals for Lisa,
mm-hmm.
and are they the same as they were when Lisa was first adopted?
Mm-hmm. This is just the worksheet we use to determine if a parcel is in agricultural use, if it's viable for continued agricultural use. So we look at how large it is. In this case, I think it's over 5 acres. So that's considered viable. If you're less than 5 acres, it's not considered viable. We look at the shape of the parcel, the topography, so the slopes. We look at the productivity from that average site value. And then we also look at if there are investments in agriculture on the site, or if it's enrolled in any governmental programs.
And how does that affect the score?
So again, if
investment in
if
conservation,
yeah,
improvement does what?
That would show that it is viable for continued agricultural use, so your score could increase.
So if I enroll in CRP, because it's low value or erodible soils, it actually increases the Lisa score.
Yeah, it's not like we'd add a point or anything. It's just that
overall,
you know, it's something that tells us that the site is compatible or viable for continued agricultural use.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But as you said, Aaron, you enrolled in CRP because it was maybe had a lot of prairie potholes on it.
Should be farmed.
Shouldn't be farmed. Mm-hmm. So yeah. That seems to be going the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm. Lose a crop.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess some of these.
What would be the other use?
Yeah, would be development again.
Oh. Right, but again,
would be good for homes.
What you have to weigh, but
which better?
Is a 1 acre acreage worse than tearing that CRP contract and in 10 years, cultivating the whole thing and stirring it up again?
Mm-hmm. Those are good points. Our next two are pretty similar. Again, we just measure the straight line distance. This time, instead of miles, it's in feet. And then we look at the distance to an urban boundary. So again, just corporate limits. And that's for both municipal water system service and sewer system service.
Why do we care? Why should I care? Why should the county care how far away you are from water,
mm-hmm.
from mass transit?
Mm-hmm.
Or sewer system. I don't think that should count.
Mm-hmm. It kind of gets to the urbanization of an area and kind of the future annexation discussion.
Mm-hmm. Our water is not a municipal water system.
I just don't understand.
The number, if it's close.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm buying or taking it.
Because what's going to happen at this place is they're going to get on rural water and dig a well, hopefully get on rural water, and they don't have their own septic system. Is that
bad thing?
No, it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
Cost. But no. But that's the reality.
This question, I don't even understand why that's in this
yeah. But that's the deal. Mm-hmm. Transition.
I guess, you know, again, we do look at these scores for things such as rezonings. So it's not just a one, it's not always just a split of 1 acre for a single dwelling. Sometimes it could be, you know, a large subdivision that we're looking at. And so for those things, and when they are within a certain distance of a city, you know, sometimes it does matter how far off water or sewer service could be, I suppose. I'm just trying to provide some sort of logic there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. If it's a small lot residential district that they're proposing, perhaps there isn't space for normal septic systems, such as like at the Irons, and then this would influence like annexation agreements that upon annexation they have to connect to the sewer, municipal water.
Which gets to the C2C plan, the urban expansion areas that we talked about.
Raises a good question, though, in particular in Ames Urban Fringe, where we've adopted policies that give, like, the city of Ames some priority to influence rural development where they think they might annex it in the future.
The transitional areas.
Does that cancel out the need for doing that with the LISA when we also evaluate it? Does it not double count that factor in essence? Mm-hmm. Because the city is saying it's important to us and LISA is saying it's important, but in some places where it's not important to the city.
But if it's in the fringe, we're looking at the fringe policies.
In addition. And then this last one is pretty similar. It's the municipal transit. So most of our cities don't actually have municipal transit, so 10 points is unavailable. Ames has SciRide. So when you get close to Ames, sometimes parcels that we evaluate with LISA are close to, I think there's a SciRide stop kind of by the mall. And sometimes in, like, West Ames, there's one out by there's, like, the Hy-Vee.
South of Ames along 69.
Yeah.
Dense residential development. That's a lot of apartment buildings and single-family dwellings, I guess.
They have a SciRide stop there. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very close to the municipal limits.
Uh-huh. And in East Ames, they have a new route, too, that kind of goes out towards Danfoss. So sometimes if we get properties near there, we look at those routes. So that's all of the factors. This is just scoring our example. So really the only points that were removed were from the distance to McCallsburg. And so it has a total LISA score of 285 and a total SA score of 194.
And the range again is what?
So you can have up to 200 points for an SA score and up to 300 points for the total LISA score.
So in a nutshell, as far as its value for being maintained for agricultural use, this ranks pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
You would not allow that acreage to be, or a new acreage to be split out of that 40 on.
Through a plat survey, you could do a residential parcel subdivision, though.
Okay.
Divide that.
Yeah.
Divide that existing one.
Provide that each lot would have the 1 acre.
Let's say there was a 40-acre undivided parcel right next to it. You would not allow someone to just plant a house there on an acre.
Mm-hmm.
Or you would?
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
And then, because the minimum lot size remains at 35 acres.
Yeah.
Okay. And then as far as somebody's proposed a rezoning or a subdivision, they wouldn't get very far with it because the LISA score is so high.
Right. We typically try to do them for conceptual review.
Yeah. Okay. So we would probably not even see one that scores this. A rezoning or a subdivision on a property that scores this high would never even make it to us likely.
Mm-mm.
Any questions about how the LISA is done? I know we're not really tackling what to do with the LISA right now.
No, but that was really helpful to understand the components that make it up and how you get there.
Because
that score means something.
Sorry.
No, you're fine. It's just that score means something to me now. It's not just.
Did you guys make all those diagrams?
I took them from, like, these charts.
All the charts, and yeah.
Yeah. They're in the worksheet. I just put them into PowerPoint. So that's what we use.
Okay, so this is the LISA score, the site assessment score.
And the site assessment score is also, the site assessment score is part of the LISA score.
Okay.
So it's added with the land evaluation score, which was 91 based on the soil types.
Okay.
So the maximum permitted site assessment would be 172, right?
Oh, for the building.
Right. And then 266 for
LISA,
the total LISA.
Total to do that 1 acre dwelling in an A1 district.
So this is a real live example
mm-hmm.
of somebody who is denied a request.
They can do a residential parcel subdivision.
And that would likely be...
With a residential parcel subdivision, we have standards that you have to meet. We haven't had one denied. If you meet the standards, it typically gets approved.
They're pretty straightforward.
So basically, if you have an existing parcel,
mm-hmm.
When it was created,
and it has a house on it,
and it has a house on it, you can split that to create another house lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that was through an amendment in 2012,
mm-hmm.
the residential parcel subdivision that allowed that to happen.
But you only get one.
Right. And you can't re-subdivide after that through the residential parcel subdivision process.
Usually it's a family member doing this.
That's right. Exactly what I was going to say. It's very popular with family members or friends.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a form of affordable housing. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had three last Tuesday, and they were all family on the Board of Supervisors agenda.
They go before the Board of Supervisors
mm-hmm.
with that type of request?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I suppose the thought is that you're not taking additional land out of production when you take an existing parcel and just turn it into two smaller ones, generally?
Generally, yeah. In this instance, I guess, you know, depending on where the house went, there might be some conflicts with the location of some of the other buildings on the site. It's a pretty full site, but...
What's the minimum number of acres for this type of...
One.
You could split a 1 acre parcel
mm-hmm.
in an A1 just...
2 acre. You could divide a 2 acre less road right away to create...
Oh, you can create
total.
One...
It needs to be one total acre in an A1.
For each parcel.
Yeah.
For each resulting parcel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one thing they could do in that example, because that does have a lot of buildings, is they could convert maybe one of those buildings to parcel living quarters, which is something that's
if they split it.
If they did the division.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the reality is you're not, on most of those applications, you're not taking very much agricultural land out of production. You know, particularly because you just have that limit, you can only do it once.
So that's any lot parcel that existed in 2012 when it was adopted? Well, so what's to keep me from taking my 40 acres and just dividing it into two?
You have to build a dwelling on it first?
It has to show up on the tax rolls.
Yeah.
There has to be one house on the site.
Well, do you live on a 40 acre parcel?
I do not.
It's been divided from the quarter, right?
It was a farmstead split.
Okay.
So your property could be divided once through the residential parcel subdivision, I'm guessing.
But if I had a home just on an original 40-acre allot lot,
mm-hmm.
I can just buy that?
Through a residential parcel subdivision?
Yeah. Regardless of the lease score?
Yeah. Quarter.
Yeah.
I would just have either two 20-acre lots or...
You could have an outlot.
So what's the point? Why do the LISA
for subdivision?
Because you can do a division through a plat of survey instead of the subdivision platting process.
Oh, so that's just a cost issue.
And so sometimes if you meet LISA...
And a timing issue.
Yeah, if you meet LISA, you can do a plat of survey, divide it once, you can build on that lot, and then you could do two residential parcel subdivisions to get a total of four dwellings.
Okay, so
And a number of them that we're looking at don't have dwellings, right? I mean,
yeah.
They're...
We do a lot of property research that says you could build a dwelling and then divide. Sorry, you don't meet Lisa. Basically.
So, I just wonder why you guys, the Lisa provision on as an exception to the minimum lot size of 35 acres is just busy, it seems like, to you. Because if somebody really wants to do it, even if they don't pass the Lisa score, they will just spend the extra money and time to do it.
You have an idea? No. How many don't have dwellings?
Yeah.
Over half.
We don't
know.
No, we don't know.
Well, you do them every day.
I don't have a cat.
Quite a few of them don't have dwellings, though. So
they don't have.
They don't have existing dwellings.
But if they could build a dwelling, then do it.
Yeah.
If they're buildable.
Yeah, if they're buildable.
Sometimes they're not buildable.
So if you have like a 12-acre piece that was created in 2014. In the A1 district, and it doesn't meet the Lisa score, and it wasn't created through a residential parcel subdivision.
It's not a lot of record.
It's not buildable.
But if I had a 40-acre original olive oil, I could build a house on it.
And then go through the residential parcel subdivision process.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Could you split an acre off the 40 and build a house?
After building the house, then doing the split to make the parcel smaller.
We've already have a house on 40 acres.
Then you can do the subdivision either way and not worry about these.
I think with that example, though, it's really hard, I think, to get a loan for a house on the 40 acres. So that does matter.
They'll give you a conventional loan over 10 acres.
Yeah.
So they need cash.
What's that?
You would need cash to build a house. Mm-hmm.
So if you have money, you can do it. And if you don't have money, you can do it.
Exactly. To me, it just feels like you're putting we continue to put the name Lisa on top of the process to suggest that we're interested in ag land preservation. But they'll be provided a way to create many lots out of a piece of farmland.
Well, and that came about in 2012 to give property owners an option, another bite at the apple.
Right.
So that
I don't mean
have
that as a criticism of you, staff. I just, it just seems like,
what's the importance of us using the Lisa if there's already a way around it?
Rezonings,
right?
Yeah, rezonings.
Yes.
But you not, might not be able to do it, though.
That's his point.
Wanted to put it out in the middle of nowhere. Then.
Right. My biggest problem with the Lisa, though, is its application to determining what your lot size is in the A1 district, using it as an exception to the 35-acre minimum. Mm-hmm. Either we think the 35-acre minimum is a good ag land preservation tool, or we don't. But why have this extra step in the process of the Lisa when you're ultimately just going to get that, do that split anyway? Find a way to do it if you have the money to do it. I'm on my soapbox.
Well, and there's only a handful of counties that have this Lisa system. Was it 6 or 7, or is it higher than that?
It's 6.
It's not very many.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it was adopted and probably continues to be an innovative tool. I'm just not sure it's applied right with regard to the 35-acre lot size as it being an exception. Hmm. Especially when we can just do an end around it and run around it anyway. So.
Mm-hmm. Complex future that you all have there.
We do have a bunch of these.
Got you. You spend a lot of time doing it, right?
Well, they don't, but I would.
Me too.
They're more efficient at it.
We're quicker. But they take, you know.
But it's interesting. If they have a close one, they don't. We have this internal rule that the other one will do it, run it, just to see if it's comparable.
With the subjective marks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are there other questions or comments about the Lisa?
Thank you.
I appreciate you putting this together. It is really
sure.
Helpful.
thanks for sliding through that commission, because I think that's really important. If we're going to discuss the policy implications of Lisa later on, we need to know how it's done. Okay, staff comments.
We're going to get the towers in October. Wind energy.
They anticipate November.
I was just talking to Emily about the Next Era. I think I told you about that at a previous meeting. They have a plan to change out 100 of the existing wind energy systems, the blades for longer blades, different gearbox systems, but that won't be before the Planning and Zoning Commission until the November meeting. So in October, we're going to have the transportation impact analysis ordinance, and then hopefully some of these ordinance amendments that we brought before you tonight, access, home business, cabin, and the dog breeding ordinance. And, of course, any applications that we get in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Commissioner comments?
You guys do an amazing job.
Thank you. We love our work.
All right. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Yeah. Second.
Second.
Your turn. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.